Hello and welcome to The Back View. This is Ian Jones from Backhouse Jones. In this podcast, we discuss everything related to transport with a side order of law. They say you should never meet your heroes. Well, I not only got to meet my legal hero, but got to work with him as well. Because in this episode, I'm coming to you from North Wales and speaking to my former colleague and transport legal legend, Mike Cunningham. Backhouse Jones was formed in 1999, and about 5 years after that, Mike joined us. Can you imagine Sir Alex Ferguson retiring from Manchester United and coming to work at Preston North End as they planned their future? Well, that's exactly how it was for the directors of Backhouse Jones when Mike joined us in the mid-noughties. So, Mike, did you always want to be a lawyer?
Well, Ian, first of all, it's very kind of you to say such nice things about me. I'm not too sure they're altogether correct, but it's been a life in transport and a life in the law surrounding transport. Did I always want to be a lawyer? No, is the answer to that. I really drifted into the law at the time, and when I was a young fellow, because I'm now rapidly approaching my 70th year, it was a very, very proud profession and one that everyone's parents wanted their children to go into. I did drift. I always wanted to be a pilot, and I tried and tried to get into the RAF, but failed miserably because of my eyesight. So I drifted into law. I was never inspired to be a lawyer.
So as a trainee solicitor, well, today they're called trainee solicitors, but in the old day it was called doing your articles. Where did you do your articles, Mike?
Well, after I got a degree from Manchester, I went to a large commercial firm, a highly specialised commercial firm in Manchester, and I did 2 years articles. In fact, it was 2.5 years articles before I went to then the Chester College of Law.
So what did you learn from your training contract,
well,
Mike?
Well, my training, or my articles, for which I was paid the handsome sum of £12 a month, were essentially in commercial work, and it was quite specialised commercial work, in particular development and the formation of limited companies and the financing of large developments. Having then qualified, I really disliked what I was doing with passion. I always had this yearning to be in court, and I applied, and to my shock and amazement, was successful in becoming a very young prosecutor in my 20s in Liverpool city centre. And of course, those were not the days of the Crown Prosecution Service. They were the days when you were a police prosecutor.
And well, what stories did you have from those days? I'm sure
there were
many.
They are legend, but as a young prosecutor, I shall always remember being blooded in Dale Street, working in the Bridewell there with the stipendiary magistrate, Norman Wooten, and coming across the likes of E. Rex Machen and Ian Levy and other such iconic solicitors and characters, where really there were no such rules as fighting with gloves on. It was fighting continually with gloves off. And for a young fellow like myself, it was a really good experience. And the stories are legion of the behaviour of some of those people, and the wit and the repartee and the warmth and friendliness at times. It was a good place to be. Liverpool is a wonderful place.
But I trained in Liverpool as well. And they say if you can litigate in Liverpool, you can litigate anywhere.
Oh, indeed. Indeed. I even after leaving Liverpool and being in private practice at Cunningham Turner, which we'll come on to, my business partner, Nicholas Turner, was a very, very good litigator, civil litigator. And I shall always remember the letter which went on the office wall from E. Rex Machen. It was in response to Nicholas Turner's rather lengthy letter requesting some kind of disclosure or whatever they do in that field. And a letter coming back, "Dear sirs, no. Yours faithfully, E. Rex Machen." And yes... Full of character, full of joy, and I'll be honest with you, most lawyers had smiles on their faces in those days.
I remember going to a seminar by Professor Makin as he became a professor. And this was about 1991 or something like that. And it was just at the time that lawyers were allowed to advertise. As you know, at the time, lawyers could only have letters in the window about 6 inches tall, but it was relinquished. It was sort of allowed for lawyers to advertise. And Professor Makin said this was the end of the profession as we would become just like butchers. You had to build a reputation. How did you go about building your... Who did you look up to as a lawyer to build your reputation?
Well, when I was a young prosecutor, I actually looked up to my then chief, who was a former tank commander, Second World War. And he was... He used to describe himself as the chief painter of the Fourth Bridge in Liverpool as the chief prosecutor. And he was a wonderful, wonderful man who inspired me to actually always prepare your work, always your best arms as a lawyer is to be prepared, to be properly prepared so that you can hopefully see what's coming and head it off, so to speak. And I shall always remember that. His name was Dick Nicholson, and he was a marvellous fellow. He was very small, about 5 feet tall. I suppose you'd have to be small to be in a tank. But marvellous man, marvellous man. And again, despite being a real warrior in every sense, he was a warm, friendly, genuine individual. And it is those kind of people that will always inspire young lawyers.
In terms of being inspired, which fictional lawyer do you look up to?
Well, man, we've had this discussion, Ian. My fictional lawyer must be Atticus Finch from the film in 1962, To Kill a Mockingbird, which was Gregory Peck. And indeed, some say I do look like Gregory Peck from one side at least. But no, joking apart, that film I just could watch and watch and watch time and time and time again. But there are other lawyers who are probably... I suppose, less infamous, and I've always enjoyed the film The Verdict, which was Paul Newman as Frank, I think Frank Galvin, as really a poor excuse as a lawyer, but how he pulled himself through because of his genuine belief in justice and what must be done. So, but recently, and I do recommend all the listeners to this, to watch the film Dark Waters, which is the film of Roger Billett, who took on, single-handed really, against all his partner's wishes, the firm DuPont in America for effectively poisoning people. And that litigation still goes on. It is a fascinating story and, again, inspirational for lawyers to not be afraid of your foe. Never be afraid of them.
I think that's the thing about lawyers. You have to stand in the shoes of your client, and the three films that you've identified there, the lawyer stood in the shoes of the individual, often to their own financial detriment. And certainly you've done that over the years for transport operators.
Yes.
What is it about Atticus Finch that you most admire?
I think it was this genuine belief that above all things, justice and the rule of law must take precedence. Otherwise, society as we know it and civilized society as we desire it will come to a crashing end. And I still believe that, and I always have believed that. In fact, I'm passionate about that. I believe that access to justice, and I have real issues with the way the UK has gone over legal aid and the availability of funding for people who need the help of lawyers. And although the reputation of lawyers at times has been bashed and battered and still is at times, lawyers have a very important part to play. And they, I believe, do deserve recognition.
Do you think that the integrity of the profession has been damaged over recent years?
Yes, I do. I do. I believe that with the advent of, with the dismantling and effective destruction of legal aid, I think lawyers then have had to turn to other courses of funding, to advertising, and to what was inevitable, a reputation of being ambulance chasers. And there is an element of that. I don't like it. I have experienced it personally within my practice, where there was a move which was an inevitable attraction, really, for any commercial practice that had to succeed financially to move towards the no win, no fee type of litigation, mass litigation. And although I never fell out with any of my business partners, it was not a route I chose to go down. But I think that has been detrimental to the long-term interests of our profession and to the long-term interests of the public at large. Legal aid, and I'm a firm believer in this, and Ian, you might not get me off this topic for some time now, but I believe that legal aid in civil proceedings was little else other than a loan to put people in a position to litigate. That was fair, it was reasonable, it was proper, it was tested properly before it was awarded. That's gone. I believe that people deserve the right to be represented in criminal courts. That has essentially gone in terms of criminal legal aid has been really reduced to something of little effect.
So, do you think, because the quality of arms has clearly gone when cost orders, when you were acquitted, were dispensed with. What was your view when that happened?
Well, I can give you many an example of that. And indeed, John Heaton, my dear, dear colleague from Backhouses and someone who I respect tremendously as a lawyer and as a person. John and I had a case where it resulted in a farmer who was quite innocent, took a criminal caution for knowingly cause harm to one of his beasts, one of his cattle, only because he could not afford a lawyer and he could not afford his own veterinary surgeon to effectively say what was obvious, that he was clearly not guilty of anything, but he took the caution. That is because he could not fund his defence, and that surely is wrong. It is inherently unjust.
And so, what do you think the characteristics are for lawyers? What are the best characteristics
for
lawyers?
I think the best characteristic of any lawyer is to be honest. They have to be honest, both with themselves and with their clients. And of course, because they are being trusted by people to take on a cause, they have to have that honesty. They have to have energy. They have to be able to listen and to understand what is being put before them and to take a course which is in the best interests of that person who is turning to them for that help. And if lawyers do that, and that is something which becomes part of their training in terms of a requirement of them, I think that is really the best you can expect.
What do you think? What can clients learn from you? What's the worst thing a client can do when it's involved with the judicial process?
I think the worst thing a client can do when it's involved in a judicial process is come with any preformed views and try or not to listen to the advice that is being given. And sometimes advice that's being given, and we all face it, whether we're lawyers or not, is not advice you want to hear, but it is usually in your best interest. And what is said between lawyer and client is confidential. And for that very reason, there should be absolute frankness and openness. Now, I say that there are times in criminal proceedings, and that includes hauliers, where the lawyer does not necessarily want to know initially whether you have or have not done a certain thing. And the lawyer needs time to assess the evidence before matters proceed further. So at times, the relationship can seem difficult for a client, and that is where a good lawyer will explain, without prejudicing anything, the relationship that will exist.
I'm thinking of a barrister who we use and we use regularly, who shall remain nameless, who is that pessimistic that when the client is seeing him, he comes out thinking, well, I might as well just plead guilty. But said barrister is just testing his arguments, isn't he?
Yes, and I don't believe in showing any particular either pessimism or optimism initially. I think there has to be this openness and this absolute honesty. It's important to create a relationship of trust. I used to say to my article clerks, because it was said to me when I was an article clerk, your job is to make sure that when that person leaves your room, they feel better than they did when they came into it. The law, you can look at when they've gone. You can all run around like headless chickens looking at the law and checking things over. But you have to build up the relationship of trust and confidence with your client.
I remember when I first saw you, it was 1999, and we went to an RHA dinner, and you were there, and you knew the RHA intimately, and you were their respected advisor. And I remember James Backhouse looking up to you going, that's what we need to do. And it was great that you came to join us. But I'm cutting across myself there, because let's just go back a moment. You did the commercial training, work out that you didn't like that, then did the prosecuting where you learned. But let's look at some crossroads moments in your careers. When you started Cunningham Turner, but before that, you worked for a big international haulage company.
I did. It was a funny little thing, because I was prosecuting in Liverpool and enjoying it tremendously. And I'd always really had an interest in large goods vehicles. I don't know why. There was no reason. There was nothing in my family in terms of the history of the Cunninghams to suggest that would be the case. And so I ended up, when I was prosecuting in Liverpool, with one of my colleagues becoming the prosecutors for the tunnel work, the tunnel prosecution,
right.
Which, as you can imagine, Ian, they were very, very busy courts. It was always court number four, and they were once a week, and it was all the offending that took place, traffic offending, in the two tunnels as they were. And a lot of that was goods vehicles, wheels falling off, overloaded or whatever. So there was that side of it. I was then poached from Liverpool. I was still in my 20s, and I was poached by John Bates, who had started the Lancashire Prosecution Service. And I was appointed as the first divisional solicitor for Burnley, Padiham and District. And together with my assistant solicitor, I was based in the Padiham Police Station and then the Burnley Police Station. And I continued to do quite a lot of then driver's hours prosecutions. And I found myself traveling around Lancashire doing them, prosecuting them. And it was at some stage whilst I was at Burnley, I was approached by the then company secretary of a firm known as Intercounty Express, which was a very, very established, very successful haulier in the Bury area. And they were being taken over by TNT, Thomas Nationwide Transport. And the company secretary wanted an assistant company secretary and a solicitor for the company. And I was attracted away. I was attracted out of prosecuting into the role of assistant company secretary and group legal advisor or some, I can't remember the title. It was equally impressive. For the TNT, then TNT Road Freight UK, which was the start of the TNT organisation really in Europe. And I say at this stage, of course, it led to a number of things, not least within fairly quick time, we were taking over and buying a lot of other haulage companies in the UK. And I learned so much, not only about the commercial side of it, because, of course, I had a commercial background of company acquisition. So to me, it was good. But I was also learning so much about the regulatory requirements, even then, in those days, which were nothing like they are now, nowhere near as stringent. But it was good. It was good experience. And it was, I have to say, TNT Road Freight in those days was a fabulous firm to work for. It was dynamic. It was a lot of young people my age, 30s. And it was a business that was going very, very quickly.
Did you ever think of going to Australia? Did they offer you the
opportunity?
Well,
I was offered to go to Australia. And at that time, the company secretary worldwide was a gentleman by the name of Rupert Nichols, an absolute gentleman, still is and as far as I know, Rupert is still working very, very hard. Very, very successful man. And a very, very good mentor. And I also used to report to Sir Fred Miller, the chairman of the TNT Group, would you believe, I used to send a telex every week of legal matters in the UK because Sir Fred was, in fact, a solicitor. But yes, great times, great times. Learned a great deal, dynamic firm, and a firm that was a really a setter of very, very high standards.
And how did that morph into you starting your own company?
After 2-3 years at TNT, I'd always had a yearning to actually be in private practice. Once, I don't know what it was. And I still couldn't put my finger on it these days. And I actually walked away from a very, very good job with, frankly, some tremendous prospects, and started MJ Cunningham & Co. on the way home from Ramsbottom, where I was based, with the blessing, although reluctant blessing, of the company secretary and the director. I bought a second-hand Adler typewriter in Bolton and took it home to the... To my wife, and appointed her promptly as my secretary and office manager, and presented her with a second-hand Adler typewriter. She was horrified. We had two infant children, two little girls, and I had just given up a job which was then paying a substantial amount of money, and had a company car and health benefits and everything else and a very good pension. So there I am.
Left. Would you do it again today?
Probably not. I probably wouldn't do it again today, but hindsight's a wonderful thing. I would, I wouldn't. There are lots. If you had hindsight, hey-ho, wouldn't it be wonderful? But I started MJ Cunningham, and I can remember my first job the following day, because one of my colleagues in the Blackburn area had found out I'd gone on my own, and he asked me to go and represent a businessman's wife for stealing from Marks and Spencer's in Blackburn. And I got her acquitted. And I don't know how. I think because she probably knew the magistrates. But hey-ho, I'll never know that one. But the end result was that I started the practice, and TNT were marvellous to me. They didn't want me to leave, but they gave me a fabulous consultancy.
Yeah.
And it was a monthly retainer. And it really was a godsend to me, because... I had little or nothing else in terms of income. And also, I got in touch with the County Prosecuting Solicitor's Office. They knew me, of course. And I was asked to prosecute road haulage offending. So road haulage compliance and what have you, which was great. It was then that Nicholas Turner joined me, and we actually, and I'm not going to dwell on this, but we created a very large firm fairly quickly, and a firm to be reckoned with, and a firm that was extremely well respected. We had some very, very good work, from very good clients, and not least some fabulous haulage companies.
Oh, no, you did, because I know certainly it was odd. Great Britain was divided up, wasn't it, between John Backhouse and Mike Cunningham. And it's quite ironic that both forces joined together eventually. But can you tell me a bit about the Wapping strike, because you were involved in that?
Yes, you mentioned John Backhouse there. He was someone who I had the highest of respect for. He was a lovely, lovely man. And I'd often ring John and say, John, I need some help. I've got this case and I don't know what to do. And he would never, ever refuse, no matter what was happening, he would never refuse or decline to help and support. The Wapping dispute. Well, what happened was Wapping dispute was 1986, Mr. Murdoch had acquired the Sun and the Times, etc., and he was determined to break the restrictive practices of Fleet Street, and in particular the print unions. So he built his state-of-the-art print centre in Wapping, or at the village there, and the National Union of Journalists, but more importantly the print unions, launched probably one of the most intense picketing that's ever been seen in the United Kingdom. It was appalling. Mr. Murdoch approached Ken Thomas and the board in Australia. And I'll squash a myth at this time. People used to say TNT are Mr. Murdoch's transport company. That is wrong. They never were, and certainly aren't now. Thomas Nationwide Transport, TNT, was not the Murdoch Group. They were good friends, and that is it. And there was joint ownership of an airline called Ansett Airways. But that was the air relationship. But TNT took on the mantle of carting newspapers once they'd been printed and distributing them throughout the United Kingdom. And it was a heck of a job they did. It was, to me, just awesome, and to Nicholas Turner, because the pair of us spent most of our time in London representing drivers and staff of TNT, who it was alleged had broken the law for one reason or another. Some of them had, in fact, but all arising out of running the pickets. We represented drivers who had been falsely set up right through to the Crown Court at Smethwick, so much so that those who'd made the allegations, respectable people, ended up themselves being prosecuted. And it was, such an exciting time, such an exciting time. And there were funny sides to it. There were very, very funny sides to it. I shall always remember running from one of the magistrates' court in London with security, that TNT security, and all the press after us, all the paparazzi running after us in hot pursuit. It was Highbury Corner Magistrates Court, and being bundled into a car and driven off just because I'd appeared in court and said certain things about people in defence of TNT drivers. Yeah, it was a great time. I shall always remember the famous case, which took me by surprise and caused many a smile in many a boardroom of TNT, was a TNT vehicle which was carrying newsprint, was 35% overloaded. And I went to the magistrates' court in wherever it was to defend the company and the driver. I hadn't seen any papers. Those were the days when you didn't get disclosure, so I had no idea what had been said to the policeman. And the lady prosecutor stood up. I'd not asked to see the papers. I was so bloody sure of myself. It was a judge sitting on his own, or a stipendiary magistrate. And the prosecutor said, and the driver was asked, "Driver, why is your vehicle so grossly overloaded?" To which he replied, "Because my wagon's not big enough." And I was horrified. And the judge just looked over his glasses at me and said, "Mr. Cunningham, have you really anything to say at all before I impose a penalty?" So, yes, it was. There were some good times.
Did you ever think of becoming a judge yourself, or a traffic commissioner even?
No, I had at one stage I was approached to sit on the employment tribunals. It was the regional chairman for the Liverpool area approached me, but I didn't pursue that. I've never wanted to be or had any desire to be a criminal judge. Well, yeah, I suppose you do at times. You think, well, it must be nice having a job where you're pensioned and you don't have to worry about where your next book's coming from. But I've never had any real desire. And it was very difficult in those days because you were in business with partners and with people. And to become a judge meant that you were away from your partnership and away from your practice. And frankly, if you didn't perform, there was usually some unhappiness. So people didn't rush to do it, not those in general practice or with successful practices. It's different now, and I understand it's different now, and people are expected to do public duty. But no, traffic commissioner-wise, I was approached to apply for the Welsh Traffic Commissioner's job many, many years ago, before I joined Backhouse Jones. And in fact, if you remember, it was the time I was dancing with Backhouse before I joined.
Yeah, I do remember.
And I'd been approached to apply, and basically had been said, well, you'll get the job. But then I found out that everybody else who was in transport law had been told the same thing. So who knows?
I remember. I'll ask you about your best and worst decision, and hopefully the worst is not joining Backhouse Jones, but it was quite funny how that came about. You'd left Cunningham Turner, which I'll let you explain if you wish to, and then you were working as a sole practitioner, and James and I were observing this thinking, if we could just get Mike Cunningham to come here. And then you and I, there was whispers in the grass, and you and I had a conversation. So we both had the same accountant, and so we went to see Graham Boys. Do you remember this?
I do.
And we sat in his room, as you, me, and James Backhouse and Graham Boyce, and we said, we just need you as a man of integrity and independent. We just sort something out, Graham. And so we all sat there, and Graham concocted something from thin air. And so he then produced this and said, can you live with this, Ian and James? Oh, I can live with that. And James and Mike said, oh, I can live with that. And I remember exactly what James Backhouse said. He said, Mike can't help but build, and he's going to come here and build. And then I think, well, I know, two of our biggest three clients are from your relationships. And James always, he still tells the trainees listeners today, you need to learn from Mike. He's sticky with his clients. And I've been on the Honk for Hope on the past couple of weeks, and I've got coach operators coming up to me saying, is that guy Cunningham still with you? Is he still smoking cigars? I said, no, he's not smoking cigars, but and he is still with us in an ambassadorial role. So going back to my question, this is a leading question, I suppose, but there we are. Don't mark me down, Mike. What's the best and worst decisions you've made in your career?
Well, it's difficult to say. And you could say, well, I suppose. Well, I would say one of the best decisions I made, because I'd left Cunningham Turner for perfectly good reasons, in that I had my transport side and Cunningham Turner had decided to go down the route of civil litigation, which is what I mentioned before about when the private funding arrangements on no win, no fee, whatever you call it, came about. Cunningham Turner chose to go down that route, and I respect and appreciate that. That was their decision. But we had a parting of ways, which was perfectly amicable. I retired from Cunningham Turner. They carried on, and I started MJ Cunningham again.
Right, we've just had a technical difficulty, so I'm just recording this on something else. So I think, Mike, you were just explaining that you started MJ Cunningham, so we'll just take it from
yes,
there.
Yes, I'd started, having left Cunningham Turner on perfectly good terms, I then started MJ Cunningham again, but purely to do my transport work. And it was then that I started to talk to backhouses. And it was strange because from the days of MJ Cunningham before Cunningham Turner and Cunningham Turner's days in what I would call the Wild Northwest, when we were representing carriers for all manner of things, and the good times, the bad times, flying round in one particular client's helicopter who was particularly successful and who was very well known, had a fabulous fleet of vehicles, operated out of the Samlesbury area, and his biggest competitor was then Eddie Stobart, which was a relatively young company then. But I shall always remember leaving the magistrate's court in Nottingham, flying in his helicopter with a commercial pilot and himself as co-pilot to the 18th tee of some country club for lunch. And then flying on the way back, we did a detour to the new Stobart office premises at Warrington and promptly flew round the offices a number of times in a helicopter with the logo of that particular client on it. Very happy days, great fun. I then continued coming back to MJ Cunningham. Those clients were very much stayed with me. And I then discussed with you, Ian, and James coming into backhouses. And that was probably one of the best decisions I ever made, which was actually stopping practicing on your own, because I began to realize, and I think I was then 50 or something like that, I began to realize that there was too much work. There was far too much demand and far too much work for me alone. In fact, before even discussing joining you, I was sending work to both James and Jonathan because I was forever overbooked, forever. And Wendy Backhouse, bless her, a brilliant, a very good lawyer in my opinion. She used to do some of the employment tribunals for me, which were all RHA employment tribunals. So I was snowed under. And that's why I had no compunction at all about coming into the backhouse fold, even though the backhouse practice was still relatively young in terms of its constitution. Then, of course, the backhouse name goes back many generations. But yeah, it was good. It was a good decision.
It was exciting times. I remember sat there with Graham Boyce, and we said, Graham, we're respected. You're respected by both of us. You're our accountant for both companies. So please just put together a package that works for everybody.
And he did.
He did a good job. We've had some laughs along the way dealing with interesting rogues and characters, shall we say.
Oh, it's really great fun. The haulage industry, people don't realise how interesting the haulage industry is, how interesting the people are that are in it, and how outrageous it can be at times. And it really can be quite outrageous and hilariously funny. and what they have to face in terms of the regulatory process and traffic commissioners who, you know, I don't think I need to tell any haulier about the reputation of some of the commissioners we've had, both deputy and full-time senior positions, which have been really very difficult for them to deal with. Very difficult. I shall remember the one, and as I'm talking to you now, sitting here, one particular incident where I was had the honour of representing a very, very large demolition company from Manchester. And they were of Southern Irish heritage, a strong Irish family who'd moved to Manchester, and they'd started that business from nothing. And the traffic commissioner, who was hearing their public inquiry, somewhat foolishly asked how it all started. That's the business. And from the back of the courtroom chirped up this delightful elderly gentleman, probably in his late 70s, beautifully dressed, a handsome fellow. And she said, Mrs. Bell, this was, as she would, come forward, come forward. And this gentleman came forward and said, now introduce yourself. And he introduced himself as effectively, I'll call him Michael for this purpose, the founder of the whole business. And she said to him, she said, well, how did your business start and how's it become so successful? And he said, I will tell you, madam. He said, me countryman blew up the middle of Manchester and I've been making money ever since. Because he was the first demolition man on the scene after the bombing of Manchester who literally started sweeping up and is, in his words, he was making money ever since. So, yes, wonderful days. But to see the look on Mrs. Bell's face and then she just cracked off laughing. So, yeah, happy times.
At least he didn't call her love, which was
No.
She didn't particularly like it.
No.
Beverly Bell, that might be an interesting podcast for us to take in the future.
Yes, I'm sure it would. I'm sure it would. Yes, Mrs. Bell could be very demanding, and there's been many a discussion in the office post-hearing by many a distressed lawyer who's come back all the way from Haydock to Clitheroe in a state. Me included.
And that's perhaps why we call you Uncle Mike, because what many people don't know is that in the office, Mike is known by the younger lawyers as Uncle Mike, because pretty much everyone has leaned on his shoulder or cried on his shoulder when coming back from public inquiry, not necessarily with Mrs. Bell, but let's wrap it up there. And Mike, thanks very much indeed for being a podcast legend, and we look forward to seeing you back in the office anytime soon.
Well, that would be brilliant, and I will be back in soon.
Cheers.
Good.